He's got to know we're onto him, but he isn't breaking off. He really thinks he can beat us.
He has for the last 4 hours, boss, Willie observed.
You know what the most important part of gambling is? You have to know when it's time to quit.
O'Malley circled up high and turned his search radar on for the first time that day. It was not very useful for detecting a periscope, but it might just scare a sub running near the surface into heading back under the layer. The sun was sinking, and O'Malley could pick out the two other helicopters working this contact from their flying lights. They dropped two lines of passive sonobuoys, each 8 miles long, at right angles to each other.
"The picket lines are in place, Hammer," Captain Perrin called. "Begin."
"Willie, Hammer!"
600 feet below the helicopter, the sonar transducer pounded the water with high-frequency sonar pulses. He did this for 1 minute, then reeled in and flew southeast. The process lasted half an hour. By this time his legs were knotting up, making his control movements awkward.
"Take over for a few minutes."
O'Malley took his feet off the pedals and worked his legs around to restore circulation.
"Hammer, Bravo, we have a contact. Buoy 6, line Echo."
This was the east-west line. Buoy number 6 was third from the west end, where the north-south November line began.
"Weak signal at this time."
O'Malley took the controls back and headed west, while the other two helicopters circled behind their respective lines.
"Gently, gently," he murmured over the intercom. "Let's not spook him too much."
He picked his course carefully, never heading directly for the contact, never heading far away from it. Another half hour passed, one miserable second at a time. Finally, they had the contact running east at about 10 knots, far below the layer.
"We now have him on 3 buoys, Perrin reported. "Hatchet is moving into position."
O'Malley watched the blinking red lights about 3 miles away. Hatchet dropped a pair of directional DIFAR buoys and waited. The display came up on O'Malley's scope. The contact passed right between the DIFARs.
"Torpedo away," Hatchet called.
The black-painted stingray dropped invisibly into the water, half a mile in front of the oncoming submarine. O'Malley closed and dropped his own buoy to listen as he brought the Seahawk into hover. Like the American Mark 48 torpedo, the Stingray didn't use conventional propellers, which made it hard to locate on sonar both for O'Malley and the submarine. Suddenly they heard the sound of propeller cavitation as the submarine went to full power and turned. Then came hull-popping noises as she changed depth abruptly to throw the fish off. It didn't work. Next came the metallic crash of the exploding warhead.
"Hit!" Hatchet called.
"Down dome."
Willie lowered the sonar transducer one last time. The submarine was coming up.
"Again," Ralston wondered. "That's two in a row."
"Set it up. Willie, hammer him.
Range 400, bearing 163. I have an up-Doppler."
"Circular search. Initial search depth 100.
"Set," Ralston replied.
O'Malley dropped his torpedo at once.
"Up dome. Bravo, the hit did not kill the target. We just dropped another one on him."
"He might be trying to surface to get his crew off," Ralston said.
"He might want to fire his missiles, too. He should have run when he had the chance. I would have."
The second hit finished the submarine. O'Malley flew straight back to Reuben James. He let Ralston land the Seahawk. As soon as its wheels were chocked and chained down, he got out and walked forward. Morris met him in the passageway between the helo hangars.
"Great job, Jerry."
"Thanks, Skipper."
O'Malley had left his helmet in the aircraft. His hair was matted to his head with perspiration, and his eyes stung from hours of it.
"I want to talk over a few things."
"Can we do it while I shower and change, Captain?"
O'Malley went through the wardroom and into his stateroom. He stripped out of his clothing in under a minute and headed for the officer's shower.
"How many pounds you sweat off on a day like this?" Morris said.
"A lot."
The pilot pushed the shower button, closing his eyes as the cold water sprayed over him.
"You know, I've been saying for 10 years that the 46 needed a bigger warhead. I hope to hell those bastards in ordnance will listen to me now."
"The second one, what was it?"
"If I had to bet, I'd say it was Papa. Great job from the sonar guys. Those steers you gave us were beautiful."
He pushed the button again for more cold water. O'Malley emerged a minute later, looking and feeling human again.
"The Commodore is writing you up for something. Your third DFC, I guess."
O'Malley thought about that briefly. His first two were for rescues, not for killing other men.
"How soon will you be ready to go up again?"
"How does next week grab you?"
"Get dressed. We'll talk in the wardroom."
The pilot raked his hair into place and changed into fresh clothing. He remembered the last time his wife had told him to use baby powder to protect his skin from the abuse of sweaty, tight clothes, and how stupid he'd been to reject the suggestion as not in keeping with aviator machismo. Despite the shower, there were a few patches of skin that would continue to itch and chafe. When he went to the wardroom, he found Morris waiting for him with a pitcher of iced bug juice.
"You got a diesel boat and 2 missile boats. How were they operating? Anything unusual?"
"Awfully aggressive. That Papa should have backed off. The Charlie took a smart route, but he was boring in pretty hard, too."
O'Malley thought it over as he drained his first glass.
"You're right. They are pushing awful hard."
"Harder than I expected. They're taking chances they ordinarily wouldn't take. What's that tell us?"
"It tells us we got 2 more busy days ahead, I guess. Sorry, Captain. I'm a little too wasted for deep thinking at the moment."
"Get some rest." Chapter 37 The Race of the Cripples. Stendal, German Democratic Republic. 2 o'clock in the morning. The attack would begin in 4 hours, despite all his efforts to change it. Alexeyev stared at the map with its symbols of friendly units and intelligence estimates of enemies.
"Cheer up, Pasha," Commander-in-Chief West said. "I know that you think we use up too much fuel. It will also destroy their remaining stocks of war supplies."
"They can resupply, too."
"Nonsense. Their convoys have suffered heavily, as our own intelligence reports have told us. They are sending 1 massive shipment across now, but the Navy tells me they are sending everything they have against it. And in any case, it will arrive too late."
Alexeyev told himself that his boss was probably right. After all, he had made his rank on the basis of a distinguished career. But still...
"Where do you want me?"
"With the OMG command post. No closer to the front than that."
The OMG command post, Pavel thought ironically. 1st 20th Guards Tank Division was supposed to be the operational maneuver group, then a 2-division formation, then 3 divisions. Every time the breakthrough maneuver had been frustrated, until the very term operational maneuver group sounded like some kind of absurd joke. His pessimism returned. The reserve formations held for exploitation of the attack were far behind the front, so as to be able to move to wherever the best penetration of NATO lines happened. It might take hours for them to reach the proper point. NATO had demonstrated a remarkable ability to compensate for sudden breakthroughs, he reminded himself. Alexeyev set this thought aside, as he had with so many others, and left the command center, collected Sergeyev, and once again found a helicopter to take him on the trip west. His aircraft waited on the ground for its usual fighter escort. The use of fighters to escort a single helicopter lifting off from Stendal was a pattern NATO air control officers had noted before. But they'd never had the available units to do anything about it. This time it was different. An AWACS control aircraft over the Rhine watched the chopper lift off with 3 MiGs in attendance. The sector controller had a pair of F-4 Phantoms returning from a counter-air mission south of Berlin, and he vectored them north. The fighters skimmed the trees, their own radars off, as they followed a safe transit lane used by Russian aircraft. Alexeyev and Sergeyev sat alone in the back of the Mi-24 attack helicopter.
There was room for 8 combat-loaded infantrymen, so both had room to stretch, and Sergeyev took the chance for a nap. Their escorting MiGs were 1,000 meters overhead, circling continuously as they watched for low-flying NATO fighters.
6 miles, came the call from the AWACS.
One Phantom popped up, illuminated 2 MiGs with its radar, and loosed a pair of Sparrow missiles. The other fired 2 Sidewinders at the helicopter. The MiGs were caught looking the wrong way when their threat receivers went off. One dashed to the ground and evaded. The other exploded in midair as the surviving wingman radioed a warning. Alexeyev blinked in surprise at the sudden gout of light overhead, then grabbed for his seatbelt as the helicopter turned hard left and dropped like a stone. It was almost in the trees when the Sidewinder chopped off the tail rotor. Sergeyev awoke and shouted in surprise and alarm. The Mi-24 spun in the air as it crashed into the trees and bounced the last 50 feet to the ground. The main rotor came apart, sending pieces in all directions, and the sliding door on the left side of the aircraft popped off as though made of plastic. Alexeyev went out right behind it, dragging Sergeyev with him. Once again his instincts had saved him. The 2 officers were 20 meters away when the fuel tanks exploded. They never heard or saw the Phantoms that continued west to safety.
"Are you hurt, Vanya?" the general asked.
"I didn't even piss my pants. That must mean I'm a seasoned veteran." The joke didn't work. The young man's voice shook along with his hands. "Where the hell are we?"
"An excellent question."
Alexeyev looked around. He hoped to see lights, but the entire country had a blackout in force, and Soviet units had learned the hard way about using lights on the highways.
"We have to find a road. We'll head south until we hit one."
"Where is south?"
"Opposite from north. That is north."
The general pointed to a star, then turned to select another.
"That one will lead us south."
Severomorsk, RSFSR. Admiral Yuri Novikov monitored the progress of the battle from his underground headquarters a few kilometers from his main fleet base. He was stung by the loss of his principal long-range weapon, the backfire bombers. But the way the Politburo had reacted to the missile attack was a greater shock. Somehow the politicians thought that it meant a ballistic missile attack from the same area was possible, and no amount of argument to the contrary would change their minds. As if the Americans would risk their precious ballistic missile subs in such restricted waters, the admiral growled to himself. He was up against fast attack boats. He was certain of it, and he was being forced to go after them with half his assets to prevent their escape. He didn't have that many assets to go around. The commander-in-chief of Soviet Northern Fleet had had a good war to this point. The operation to seize Iceland had gone almost perfectly, the boldest Soviet attack ever staged. The very next day he had smashed a carrier battle group, an epic victory for his forces. His plan to use his missile-armed bombers and submarines in combination against the convoys had worked well, particularly after he'd decided to use the bombers to eliminate the escort ships first. Submarine losses to date had been heavy, but he'd expected that. The NATO navies had practiced anti-submarine warfare for generations. There had to be losses. He'd made mistakes, Novikov admitted to himself. He should have gone after the escorts in a systematic way sooner. But Moscow wanted the merchants killed most of all, and he'd acceded to the suggestion. Things were changing now. The sudden loss of his backfire force, it would be out of action for another 5 days, forced him to take his dedicated anti-carrier submarine teams and send them against the convoys, which meant crossing NATO's picket line of submarines, and losses there were heavy too. His force of bare reconnaissance bombers was hard hit.
The damned war was supposed to be over by now, Novikov thought angrily.
He had a powerful surface force waiting to escort additional troops to Iceland. But he couldn't move that group until the campaign in Germany was within sight of its conclusion. No battle plan survives the first contact with the enemy, he reminded himself. Comrade Admiral, satellite photographs have arrived. His aide handed over a leather dispatch case.
The fleet intelligence chief arrived a few minutes later with his senior photo interpretation expert. The photos were spread out across the table.
"Ah, we have a problem here," the photo expert said.
Novikov didn't need the expert to tell him that. The piers at Little Creek, Virginia, were empty. The American Amphibious Assault Force had sailed with a full Marine division. Novikov had watched the progress of Pacific Fleet units to Norfolk with great interest. But then his ocean reconnaissance satellites had both been killed, and launch authority on the last of them had been withheld. The next photo showed the carrier berths, also empty.
"Nimitz is still at Southampton," his intelligence chief pointed out.
"He came into port with a severe list, and there is no dry dock large enough to accommodate him. He's tied to the ocean dock. He's not going anywhere. That gives the Americans three carriers, Coral Sea, America, and Independence. Saratoga is being used for convoy escorting duties. The rest of their Atlantic Fleet carriers are in the Indian Ocean."
Novikov grunted.
That was bad news for the Indian Ocean squadron, but they were part of the Soviet Pacific Fleet. Not his problem. He had enough of his own. For the first time, he faced a dilemma that he'd inflicted on the NATO navies. He had more tasks than he had ships, and sending half of his dedicated ASW forces after submarines that were already retreating didn't help matters. Northwood, England.
"Hello again, Admiral," Toland said.
Beatty looked much better. The blue eyes had the gleam of crystal now, and the Admiral's back was ramrod straight as he stood in front of his wall-sized map with his arms folded.
"How are things in Scotland, Commander?"
"Good, sir.
The last two raids got chewed up. May I ask how the Doolittle force made out? One of the boats is commanded by a friend of mine."
Beatty turned.
"Which?"
"Chicago, sir. Dan McCafferty."
"Oh, it would seem that one of the boats was damaged. Chicago and one other are escorting her out. In fact, they are raising quite a rumpus in the Eastern Barents. We have indications that the Soviets are sending a sizable force after them. In any case, you're going back to your carrier fleet, and you're to meet with my intelligence staff so that you can bring your chaps up to date when you get there. I wanted to see you personally to thank you for that telex you sent about trailing the backfires to their doorstep. That idea was very useful to us. You're a reservist, I understand. How on earth did they ever let you go?"
"I put my destroyer on a sandbar once."
"I see.
You have atoned for that error, Commander."
Beatty offered his hand.
Wackersleben, German Democratic Republic.
"Stop that goddamn truck!" Alexeyev screamed.
He stood in the middle of the road, daring the vehicle to run over him. It stopped, and he ran around to the cab.
"Who the hell are you?" the corporal asked.
"I am General Colonel Alexeyev," he answered agreeably. "Who might you be, comrade?"
"I am Corporal Vladimir Ivanich Maryakin."
He managed to say this, despite a mouth that hung open on seeing the general's shoulder boards.
"Since I appear to outrank you, Corporal, you will take me and my aide to the next traffic control point as quickly as this truck will go. Move."
Alexeyev and Sergeyev got in the back. They found a solid mass of crates, but had enough room to sit on top of them. The general swore. 3 wasted hours. It could have been worse.
Brussels, Belgium.
"It's a major attack, sir. They just started moving on what looks like an 80-kilometer front."
Sakyur looked at the map impassively. It wasn't as though they hadn't expected this. Intelligence had predicted it 12 hours earlier from Soviet traffic patterns. He had exactly 4 reserve brigades that he could use in this sector. "Thank God," he thought, "that I managed to persuade the Germans to shorten the line at Hanover." Half his reserves had come from that, and not a day too soon.
"Main axis of the attack?" the general asked his operations officer.
"None is apparent at the moment. It looks like a general attack."
"Pushing hard to find a weak point," Sakyur finished the statement.
Where's their reserve force?
Sir, we've identified elements of 3 divisions here south of Folsihausen. They appear to be A units. The attack now underway appears to be mainly B formations.
Have we hurt them that bad? Sackure asked rhetorically.
His intelligence officers were working hard to establish just what enemy casualties were, and he got a report every evening. B-class reserve units had started appearing at the front 5 days before, which was puzzling. He knew the Soviets had at least 6 Category A units in reserve in the southern Ukraine, but there were no indications they were moving. Why wasn't this force being committed to the German front? Why were they sending reservists instead? He'd been asking that question for several days, only to get shrugs from his intelligence chief. Not that I'm complaining, he thought. Those 2 field armies might have been enough to rupture his front entirely.
Where's a good place to hit back?
Sir, we have these 2 German tank brigades at Springe. The Russian attack appears to have 2 reserve motor rifle divisions with a divisional border right here, 10 kilometers from them. They've been off the line for 2 days now. I wouldn't call them well-rested, but...
Yeah.
Sackure was given to cutting his officers off. Get him moving. USS Reuben James. O'Malley circled the frigate after a long morning's search for what turned out to be nothing. 3 merchant ships had died in the past 3 hours, 2 to missiles that had leaked through the convoy's SAM defenses, and 1 to a torpedo. Both submarines had been prosecuted, 1 sunk by Gallery's Hilo inside the convoy itself. They were about to come within ground-based air coverage from the European mainland, and it seemed to the pilot that they'd won this battle. The convoy was getting across with acceptable losses. 36 more hours to landfall. The landing was routine, and after a trip to the head, O'Malley went into the wardroom for a drink and a sandwich. He found Calloway waiting for him. The pilot had met the reporter briefly, but not really spoken with him.
"Is landing your helicopter on this little toy ship as dangerous as it looks?"
"A carrier has a slightly larger deck. You're not doing a story about me, are you?"
"Why not? You killed 3 submarines yesterday."
O'Malley shook his head.
2 ships, 2 helos, plus some help from the rest of the screening force. I just go where they send me. There's a lot to sub-hunting. All the parts have to work or the other guy wins."
"Is that what happened last night?"
"Sometimes the other guy does something right, too. I just spent 4 hours looking and came away empty. Maybe that was a sub, maybe not. Yesterday was pretty lucky all the way around."
"Does it bother you, sinking them?" Calloway asked.
"I've been in the Navy for 17 years, and I've never met anybody who likes killing people. We don't even call it that, except maybe when we're drunk. We sink ships and try to pretend that they're just ships, things without people in them. It's dishonest, but we do it anyway. Hell, this is the first time I've actually done what my main job is supposed to be. Until now, all my combat experience has been search and rescue stuff. I never even dropped a war shot on a real sub until yesterday. I haven't thought about it enough to know if I like it or not."
He paused.
"It's an awful sound. You hear rushing air. If you penetrate the hull at deep depth, the sudden pressure change inside the hull supposedly causes the air to ignite, and everyone inside the boat incinerates. I don't know if it's true, but somebody told me that once. Anyway, you hear the rushing air. Then you hear the screech, like a car throwing its brakes on hard. That's the bulkheads letting go. Then comes the noise of the hull collapsing. Hollow boom, sort of. And that's it. 100 people just died. No, I don't much like it."
"The hell of it is, it's exciting," O'Malley went on. "You're doing something extremely difficult. It requires concentration and practice and a lot of abstract thought. You have to get inside the other guy's head, but at the same time you think of your mission as destroying an inanimate object. Doesn't make much sense, does it? So what you do is you don't think about that aspect of the job. Otherwise, the job wouldn't get done."
"Are we going to win?"
That's up to the guys on land. All we do is support them. This convoy is going to make it.
Faltzehausen, Federal Republic of Germany.
They told me you were dead, Bergavoy said.
Not even scratched this time.
It startled Vanya here out of a sound sleep, however.
How does the attack go?
Initial signs are promising. We have an advance of 6 kilometers here, and almost as much here at Springer. We might have Hanover surrounded by tomorrow.
Alexeyev found himself wondering if his superior had been right.
Perhaps NATO lines had been thinned so much they'd been forced to give ground.
Comrade General,
it was the Army intelligence officer.
I have a report of German tanks at El Dagzin. He just went off the air.
Where the hell is El Dagzin? Bergavoy peered down at the map.
That's 10 kilometers behind the line. Confirm that report.
The ground shook under them, followed by the roar of jet engines and launching missiles.
They just hit our radio transmitters, the communications officer reported. Switch to the alternate, Alexeyev shouted.
That was the alternate. They took out the primary last night, Bergavoy answered. Another is being assembled now. So we use what we have here.
No, Alexeyev said. If we do that, we do it on the move.
I can't coordinate well that way.
You can't coordinate at all if you're dead.
USS Chicago.
All hell was breaking loose. It was like a nightmare, except you woke up from those, McCafferty reminded himself. At least 3 Bear F patrol aircraft were overhead, dropping sonoboys all over the place. 2 Krivak-type frigates and 6 Grisha patrol boats had shown up on the sonar, and a Victor III submarine had decided to come to the party. Chicago had nibbled the odds down some. For the past few hours, fancy footwork had killed a Victor and a Grisha and damaged a Krivak. But the situation was deteriorating. The Russians were mobbing him, and he would not be able to keep them at arm's length much longer.
In the time it had taken him to localize and kill the Victor, the surface groups had closed 5 miles on him. Like a boxer against a puncher, he had the advantage only as long as he kept them away.
What McCafferty wanted and needed to do was talk with Todd Sims on Boston to coordinate their activities. He couldn't because the underwater telephone couldn't reach that far and made too much noise. Even if he tried to make a radio broadcast, Boston would have to be near the surface, with her antenna up to hear him. He was sure Todd had his boat as deep as he could drive her.
American submarine doctrine was for each boat to operate alone. The Soviets practiced cooperative tactics, but the Americans never felt the need. McCafferty needed some ideas now. The book solution to the tactical problem at hand was to maneuver and look for openings. But Chicago was essentially tied to a fixed position and could not stray too far from her sisters. As soon as the Russians understood that there was a cripple out there, they'd close in like a pack of dogs to finish Providence off, and he would not be able to stop them. Ivan would gladly exchange some of his small craft for a 688.
"Ideas, XO?" McCafferty asked.
"How about Scotty beam us up?"
The executive officer tried to brighten things a bit. It didn't work.
So, okay, maybe the skipper wasn't a Star Trek fan.
"The only way I see to keep them off our friends is to get them to chase us a while."
"Go east and attack this group from the beam?"
"It's a gamble," the exec admitted.
"But what isn't?"
"You con her. 2/3. And hug the bottom."
Chicago turned southeast and increased speed to 18 knots. This was a fine time to find out how accurate our charts are, McCafferty thought. Did Ivan have any minefields set here? He had to shut that thought out. If they hit one, he'd never know it. The executive officer kept the submarine within 50 feet of where the chart said the bottom was. Actually, he hedged, keeping 50 feet above the highest bottom marker within a mile. Even that would do no good if there was an uncharted wreck. McCafferty remembered his first trip into the Barents Sea. Somewhere close to here, were those destroyers sunk as targets. If he hit one of those at 18 knots, the run lasted 40 minutes.
"All ahead one-third," McCafferty ordered when he couldn't stand it anymore.
Chicago slowed to 5 knots. "To the diving officer. Take her up to periscope depth." The plainsmen pulled back on their controls. There was some minor groaning from the hull as the outside water pressure relented, allowing the hull to expand an inch or so. On McCafferty's order, the ESM mast went up first. As before, there were several radar sources. The search periscope went up next. A weather front was moving in, with a rain squall to the west.
"Fabulous," McCafferty thought. "There goes 10% of our sonar performance." "I got a mast at 264. What is it?"
"No radar signals on that bearing," a technician said.
"It's broken. It's the Krivak. We got a piece of her. Let's finish her off.
A shadow went across the lens. McCafferty angled the instrument up and saw the swept wings and propellers of a bear.
"Con, sonar, multiple sonoboys aft."
McCafferty slapped the scope handles up and lowered the scope. "Take her down. Make your depth 400 feet. Left full rudder, all ahead full." A sonoboy deployed within 200 yards of the submarine. The brassy sound of its pings reverberated through the hull. "How long for the bear to turn and drop on us?" On McCafferty's order, a noisemaker was ejected into the water. It didn't work, and he fired off another. 1 minute passed. "He'll try to get a magnetic fix on us first. Rewind the tape." The duty electrician was grateful to have something to do. The video record of his 5-second periscope exposure showed what looked like the remains of a Krivak's topsides. "Passing 300 feet. Speed 20 and increasing."
"Scrape the bottom, Joe," McCafferty said.
He watched the tape rerun, but that was only to have something for his eyes to do.
"Torpedo in the water, port quarter. Torpedo bearing 015. Right 15 degrees rudder. All ahead flank. Come to new course 175.
McCafferty put the torpedo on his stern. His mind went through the tactical situation automatically. Russian ASW torpedo. 16-inch diameter. Speed about 36 knots. Range 4 miles. Runs about 9 minutes. "We're doing," he looked, 25 knots. "It's behind us. So if he's a mile behind us, 7 minutes to cover the distance. It can get us. But we're accelerating at 10 knots per minute. No, it can't."
"High-frequency pinging aft. Sounds like a torpedo sonar."
"Settle down, people. I don't think it can catch us." "Any Russian ship in the neighborhood can hear us, though."
"Passing through 400 feet. Starting level out."
"Torpedo is closing, sir," the sonar chief reported. "The pings sound a little funny, like..." The sub shook with a powerful explosion aft.
"All ahead one-third. Right 10 degrees rudder. Come to new course 265. What you just heard was their fish hitting the bottom. Sonar, start feeding me data."
The Russians had a new line of sonoboys north of Chicago, probably too far off to hear them. Bearings to the nearest Soviet ships were steadying down. They were heading right for Chicago.
"Well, that'll keep them off our friends for a while, XO."
"Super. Let's go south some more and see if we can get them to pass us. Then we'll remind them what they're up against." Iceland. "If I ever get off this rock alive," Edwards thought, "I'll move to Nebraska." He remembered flying over the state many times. It was so agreeably flat. Even the counties were nice, neat squares. Not so in Iceland. For all that, it was easier going than they had enjoyed since leaving Keflavik. Edwards and his party kept to the 500-foot elevation line, which kept them at least 2 miles from the gravel coast road, with mountains at their back and a good long field of view. Up to now, they had seen nothing more than routine activity. They assumed that every vehicle on the move had Russians aboard. That probably was not true. But since the Soviet troops had appropriated so many civilian vehicles, there was no way to tell the sheep from the goats. That made them all goats.
"Enjoying your rest, Sarge?"
Edwards and his group caught up with Smith. There was a road half a mile farther ahead, the first they'd seen in 2 days.
"See that mountaintop?" Smith pointed. "A chopper landed on it 20 minutes ago."
"Great."
Edwards unfolded his map and sat down. "Hill 1063. That's 3,500 feet.
"Makes a nice lookout point, don't it?"
"You suppose they can see us from there?"
10 or 11 miles. Depends, Skipper. I figure they're using it to watch the water on both sides. If they have any brains, they'll keep an eye on the rocks, too."
"Any idea how many people they have there?" Edwards asked.
"No way.
Maybe nobody. Hell, they might have been making a pickup, but I wouldn't bet on it.
Maybe a squad. Maybe a platoon.
You gotta figure they have a good pair of spotting glasses and a radio."
"And how do we get past them?" Edwards asked.
The ground was mostly open, with only a few bushes in sight.
"That's a real good question, Skipper. Pick our routes carefully, keep low, use dead ground, all the usual stuff. But the map shows a little bay that comes within 4 miles of them. We can't detour around the far side without running into the main road. Can't hardly do that."
"What's the problem?" Sergeant Nichols arrived. Smith explained matters. Edwards got on the radio.
"You just know they're on the hilltop, not strength or weapons, right?" Doghouse asked.
"Correct."
"Damn. We wanted you on that hill."
"Now, there's a surprise," Edwards thought.
"No chance you can go up that hill?"
"None. Say again, no chance at all. I can think of easier ways to commit suicide, mister. Let me think this one over and get back to you, okay?"
"Very well. We'll be waiting. Out."
Edwards got his sergeants together, and they started exploring the maps.
"Really a question of how many men they have there, and how alert they are," Nichols thought. "If they have a platoon there, we can expect some patrol activity. Next question is how much? I wouldn't be very keen on doing that hill twice a day myself."
"How many men would you put there?" Edwards asked.
"Ivan has a whole paratroop division here, plus other attachments. Call it 10,000 men total. He can't garrison the entire island, can he?
So, would he have a rifle platoon on this or any other hilltop, or just a spotting team? Artillery observers, that sort of mob.
They're looking for your invasion force, and from up there a man with a decent spyglass can cover all of this bay to our north, and probably see all the way to bloody Keflavik the other way. They'll also be looking for aircraft."
"You're trying to make it sound easy?" Smith wondered.
"I think we can approach the hill safely enough, then wait for nightfall, what of it we have, and try to pass under them then. They will have the sun in their eyes, you know."
"You've done this before?" Edwards asked.
Nichols nodded. "Falklands. We were there a week before the invasion to scout various things. Same thing we're doing now."
"They haven't said anything on the radio about an invasion."
"Lieutenant, this is where your Marines are going to land. No one's told me as much, but they didn't send us here to find a football pitch, did they?"
Nichols was in his mid-30s, approaching 20 years of service. He was by far the oldest member of the party, and the past few days of serving under a rank amateur had chafed on him. The one nice thing about this young weatherman, however, was his willingness to listen.
"Okay, they wanted us on this hill to eyeball things, too. How about this smaller peak to the west of the main summit?"
"We'll have to go far out of our way to be able to climb without being seen, but yes, we can establish ourselves there, I think. So long as they are not terribly alert, that is."
Okay, once we cross this road, we keep together in one group.
You got the point, Sergeant Nichols. I'd suggest we rest up a bit. Looks like we'll have to be on the move for quite a while once we get moving.
8 miles to the foot of the hill. We will want to be there about sunset.
Edwards checked his watch.
Okay, we start moving in an hour.
He walked over to Vigdis.
So, Michael, what do we do now?
He explained the situation to her at length.
We're going to be close to some Russians. It might be dangerous.
You ask if I want to not go with you?
Say yes and hurt her feelings. Say no and...
Shit.
I don't want to see you hurt anymore.
I stay with you, Michael. I am safe with you.
Southampton, England. It took several hours to pump out the water that had given her the false list, an impression that had been reinforced by the ostentatious activities of divers. The powerful tugs, Catcombe and Vecta, moved her slowly aft into the Solent. Her flight deck had been fully repaired by the Vosper shipwrights, though so much of the gray steel showed the slapdash bandage work of a job done more in haste than in consideration for the ship's proud name. 2,000 men had done the job. New arresting gear had been flown in from America, along with electronic equipment that came nowhere near replacing what the Russian missiles had destroyed. The tugs escorted her to Calshot Castle. Then she moved alone south to Thorn Channel, east by the yachts docked at Cowes. Escorts were waiting at Portsmouth. Then the small formation turned south and west into the English Channel. Flight operations began at once. The first aircraft to arrive were the Corsair attack bombers, then the heavier intruders and the sub-hunting Vikings. USS Nimitz was back in business. USS Chicago. And shoot! 3 hours of excruciating work distilled down to half a second. The now familiar shudder of compressed air ejected a pair of torpedoes into the black water of the Barents Sea. The Soviet commander had been just a little too eager to verify Chicago's death, and allowed his frigate to run in close behind his two remaining Grishas. All three ships were pinging at the bottom, looking for a dead submarine.
You didn't expect us to run south, did you?
North or east, maybe, but not south. McCafferty had maneuvered his submarine wide around the Russian frigate, staying at the fringe of her sonar range, then closed up 2,000 yards behind her. One fish for the Krivak, and one running for the nearest patrol boat.
No change in target course and speed, sir.
The torpedo raced after the Soviet frigate.
He's still pinging the other way, sir.
The waterfall display lit up, a bright dot on the contact's tone line. Simultaneously, the thundering explosion echoed through the hull.
Upscope!
McCafferty met the eyepiece at deck level and worked it up slowly.
That's a kill. We broke her back.
Okay.
He turned to the bearing of the near Grisha.
Okay, target number two is turning.
Wow, there go his engines, increasing speed and going left.
Skipper, the wire's cut on the fish.
How long on the run?
Another 4 minutes, sir.
In 4 minutes, at full speed, the Grisha would be outside the torpedo's acquisition radius.
Damn, it's going to miss. Downscope, let's get out of here.
We'll go east this time. Make your depth 400, all ahead 2/3. Come right to 055.
Must have been the shock of the explosion, sir. Half a second later, the control wires let go on the number two fish.
McCafferty and his weapons officer re-examined the plot.
You're right. I cut that one too close.
Okay.
The captain stepped over to the chart table.
Where do you figure our friends are?
Right about here, sir. 20 to 25 miles.
I think we've taken enough heat off them. Let's see if we can get back up there while Ivan tries to figure out what's going on.
"We've been lucky, Skipper," the exec observed.
"That's true enough. I want to know where their submarines are. That Victor we got just walked across our sights. Where are the rest of them? They can't just be chasing after us with these."
Of course not, McCafferty realized. The Russians set up hunting preserves, sectors limited to specific types of ships. Their surface ships and aircraft would be in one sector, and next to it their submarines would have exclusive hunting rights. He told himself that he'd done well to date. 3 patrol boats, a full-sized frigate, and a sub. Quite a week in anybody's book. But it wasn't over. Not until they got Providence to the ice. Chapter 38 Stealth on the Rocks. Iceland. The first leg of the trip was only 8 miles in a straight line. But the line they traveled was straight in no dimension. The terrain here was volcanic also, littered with rocks, large and small. The large ones made shadows, and whenever possible they stayed in them. But with every step they had also to detour, uphill and down, left and right, until every yard of forward travel was accompanied by a yard in another direction, and 8 miles became 16. For the first time, Edwards knew that he was under possible observation. Even when the hilltop they skirted was hidden by a ridge, who could say that the Russians did not have another scouting party out? Who could be sure that they were not being watched, that some Russian sergeant with binoculars had noticed their rifles and packs, then picked up his portable radio and sent out a call for an armed helicopter? The effort of the walk made their hearts beat fast. Fear made their hearts beat faster still, compounding their fatigue like interest on a usurer's loan. Sergeant Nichols proved an efficient leader and a hard one. The oldest member of the party, his stamina, sore ankle and all, amazed Edwards. They all kept quiet. No one wanted to make noise, and Nichols was unable to growl at those too slow to keep up. His contemptuous look was enough.
"He's 10 years older than me," Edwards told himself, "and I'm a track man. I can keep up with this bastard, can't I?"
Nichols managed to keep them clear of the coast road for most of their journey. But there was one point where the road looped around a small cove to within a mile of their path. Here they faced a cruel choice. Risk observation from the road, where the traffic was probably Russian, or from the mountaintop. They risked the road, slowly and gingerly, as they watched traffic motor along every 15 minutes or so. The sun was low in the northwestern sky as they crept up a ravine with steep walls. They found a rock pile to rest in before their dash below the observation post.
"Well, that was a nice day's walk, wasn't it?" the sergeant of Royal Marines asked.
He wasn't even sweating.
"You trying to prove something, Sergeant?" Edwards asked.
He was.
"Sorry, Lieutenant. Your friends told me you were in proper shape."
"I don't think I'll have a heart attack just yet, if that's what you mean." "Now what?"
"I'd suggest that we wait an hour until the sun sinks lower, then press on. 9 more miles. We'll want to move as quick as we can."
"Sweet Jesus," Edwards thought. He kept his face impassive.
"You sure they won't see us?"
"Sure?
No, I am not sure, Lieutenant. Twilight is the hardest time to see, however. The eye cannot adjust from the bright sky to the dark ground."
"Okay, you got us this far. I'm going to go and check on the lady." Nichols watched him walk off.
"I would not mind seeing the lady myself."
"That wasn't a good thing to say, Nick," Smith observed quietly.
"Come on, you know what he's—"
"Nick, talk nice about the lady," Smith warned. He was tired, but not that tired.
"She's had a bad time, man. And the skipper's a gentleman, you dig?
Hey, I thought he was a wimp, too. I was wrong. Anyway, Miss Vigdis, man, that's one hell of a lady."
Mike found her curled up in a fetal position next to a rock. Rogers was keeping an eye on her and moved off when the lieutenant arrived.
"How are you?" Mike asked.
She turned her head fractionally.
Dead. Michael, I am so tired.
Me too, babe.
Mike sat down beside her and stretched his legs out, wondering if the muscle tissue would just fall off the bones. He was strong enough to stroke her hair. It was matted with sweat, but Mike was past noticing such things.
Just a little while longer.
Hey, you're the one who wanted to stay with us, remember?
I am fool.
There was a note of humor in her voice.
As long as you can laugh, Mike remembered his father saying, you are not defeated.
Come on, you better stretch those legs out or they're gonna knot up. Come on, roll over.
Edward straightened her legs and massaged her calves briefly.
What we need is some bananas.
What?
Her head came up.
Bananas have lots of potassium. Helps to prevent cramps.
Or was it calcium for pregnant women, he wondered.
What do we do when we get to our new hill?
We wait for the good guys.
They come?
Her voice changed slightly.
I think so.
And you leave then?
Mike was quiet for a moment, measuring his boldness against his shyness.
What if she says,
not without you, I don't.
He hesitated again.
I mean, if that's...
Yes, Michael.
He lay down beside her. Edwards was startled by the fact that he desired her now. She was no longer the victim of rape, or a girl pregnant by another man, or a strange person from another culture. He was awed by her inner strength and other things for which he had no names, and needed none.
You're right. I do love you.
Son of a bitch. He held her hand as both rested for the task ahead.
USS Chicago.
That's one of them, sir. Providence, I think. I got some funny transients like metal pieces beating against each other.
They'd been tracking the target. Every contact was a target. For 2 hours. Closing very carefully as the possible noise source changed into a probable one. The overhead storm degraded their sonar performance measurably, and the target's stealth prevented their developing a signature identification for an agonizing period. Might she be a Russian sub creeping in search of her own target? Finally, the faint rattles from the damaged sail betrayed her. McCafferty ordered his boat to close the target at 8 knots.
Had Providence repaired her sonar systems?
Certainly they'd try, McCafferty thought. And if they then detected a submarine approaching very cautiously from the rear, would they think this was their old friend Chicago, or another Victor III? For that matter, how sure were they that their target was Providence? That was why American subs were trained to operate alone. Too many uncertainties attached to cooperative operations.
They'd left the Soviet surface forces behind. McCafferty's hit-and-run maneuver had fooled them, and before the noise faded out, they listened to a spirited hunt involving aircraft and surface forces, now 30 miles astern. That was a positive development, but the absence of any surface ships in this area made McCafferty uneasy. He might now be in a submarine-dedicated sector, and submarines were by far the more dangerous opponents. His earlier success against the Victor had been pure luck. That Soviet skipper had been too interested in starting his own hunt to check his flanks. It was a mistake he did not expect to be repeated.
Range? McCafferty asked his tracking party.
About 2 miles, sir.
That was the fringe of Gertrude range, but McCafferty wanted to get a lot closer than that.
Patience, he told himself.
Submarining was a continuous exercise in patience. You spent hours in preparation for a few seconds of activity. It's a wonder we don't all have ulcers.
20 minutes later, they had closed to within 1,000 yards of Providence.
McCafferty lifted the Gertrude phone.
Chicago calling Providence. Over.
You took your time about it, Danny.
Where's Todd?
He went off west after something 2 hours ago. We lost him. No noise at all from that direction.
What's your condition?
The tail works. Rest of our sonar's shot. We can shoot fish from the torpedo room control systems. Still raining in the control room, but we can live with it as long as we stay above 300 feet.
Can you go any faster?
We tried going to 8 knots. Found out we couldn't keep it up. The sail's coming apart. The noise just gets worse. I can give you 6. That's it.
Very well. If you got a working tail, we'll try to take station a few miles ahead. Call it 5 miles.
Thanks, Danny.
McCafferty hung up the phone.
Sonar, you got anything that even looks like it might be something?
No, sir. It's clear right now.
All ahead 2/3.
So where the hell is Boston? The captain asked himself.
Funny how quiet things have got, the exec pointed out.
Tell me about it.
I know I'm acting paranoid, but am I acting paranoid enough?
McCafferty needed the laugh.
Okay, we sprint and drift north, 15-minute sprint, 10 drift, until we're 5 miles ahead of Providence. Then we settle down to 6 knots and continue the mission. I'm going to catch a nap. Wake me in 2 hours. Talk to the division officers and chiefs, make sure the troops are getting some rest. We've been pushing pretty hard. I don't want anybody to fold up.
McCafferty grabbed half a sandwich as he walked forward. It was only 8 steps to his stateroom. The food was swallowed by then.
Captain to control!
It seemed he had only just closed his eyes when the speaker over his head went off. McCafferty checked his watch on the way out the door. He'd been asleep for 90 minutes. It would have to do.
What do we got? He asked the exec.
Possible submarine contact on the port quarter. Just picked it up. We got a bearing change already. It's close.
No signature yet.
Boston?
Could be.
I wish Todd hadn't gone off like that, McCafferty told himself.
He found himself wondering if they shouldn't just tell Providence to go to her best speed and screw the noise.
That was fatigue talking, he knew. Tired people make mistakes. Especially judgmental errors.
Captains can't afford those, Danny.
Chicago was making 6 knots.
No noise at all, the captain thought. Nobody can hear us.
Maybe.
Probably.
You don't really know anymore, do you?
He went into the sonar room.
How you feeling, Chief?
Hanging in there, Skipper. This contact's a beaut. See how he fades in and out. He's there all right, but it's a cast-iron bitch to hold him.
Boston headed off west a few hours ago.
Could be him coming back, sir. Lord knows he's quiet enough. Or it could be a tango on battery, sir. I don't have enough signal to tell the difference.
Sorry, sir. I just don't know.
The chief rubbed raw eyes and let out a long breath.
How long since you had any rest?
I don't know that either, sir.
When we finish up this one, you hit the rack, Chief.
The tracking party officer called forward next.
I have a working range for you, sir. 5,000 yards. I think he's on an easterly course. Trying to firm that up.
McCafferty ordered a fire control solution to be run on the contact.
What's this? The chief asked.
Another sonar contact behind the first one, bearing 253. He's following the other guy.
I need an ID, Chief.
I don't have enough data, Captain. Both these guys are creeping.
Is Boston one of them?
If so, which?
If the one in front, do we warn him and reveal our position? Or shoot and risk shooting at the wrong one?
Or just do nothing at all?
McCafferty went aft to the plotting board.
How close is this one to Providence?
Just over 4,000 yards, coming in on her port bow.
He probably has her then, the captain thought aloud.
But who the hell is he? The tracking officer asked quietly,
And what's this Sierra 2 contact behind him?
Transient, transient, the sonar chief called. Mechanical transient on Sierra 2.